Our text today is Ezra chapter 8. In case that made any of you startled with terror, we are actually going to skip the genealogy in the beginning. But not because it's worthless. It's very important that you see, the census. There we go. Thank you very much. The census. And why is it important? Because God shows that he keeps his promises. And he shows specifically, so he can, with records kept, look, I said people would come home and they'd rebuild. And look, these exact people did it. My promises are sure. It's a gift of God to give us these things, which we often just kind of cast aside. We will not be preaching through the specifics of the census, but it is not a waste of space. It is God showing one more way that he keeps his promises and leaves reminders of them. So in case we would doubt, we can go check and see, yes, his word is sure. So we will pick up in verse 15 of Ezra chapter 8. Hear now the word of the Lord. Actually, I'm going to read verse 1, and then I'll skip to verse 15. These are the heads of their fathers' houses, and this is the genealogy of those who went up with them to Babylonia, the origin, the reign of Artaxerxes, their king. See, I guess it is kind of a genealogy, so I wasn't that off. Verse 15, I gathered them to the river that runs to Ahava, and there we camped 3 days, and I reviewed the people and the priests. I found there none of the sons of Levi. Then I sent for Eleazar, Ariel, Shemaiah, Jerib, Nathan, Zechariah, and Meshulam, leading men, and for Joirib and Elnathan, who were men of insight, and sent them to Iddo, the leading man at the place of Casiphia, telling them what to say to Iddo and his brothers and the temple servants at the place Casiphia, namely, to send us ministers for the house of our God. And by the good hand of our God on us, they brought us a man of discretion, of the son of Mali, the son of Levi, son of Israel, namely, Sherebiah, and his sons and kinsmen, 18, and Hashabiah, and with him, Jeshiah of the sons of Merari, and his kinsmen, their sons, 20, besides 220 of the temple servants whom David and his officials had set apart to attend the Levites. These were all mentioned by name. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him a safe journey for ourselves, our children, and all our goods. For I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, the hand of our God is for good on all who seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all who forsake him. So we fasted and implored our God for this, and he listened to our entreaty. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests, Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and 10 of their kinsmen with them. And I weighed out to them the silver and the gold and the vessels, the offering for the house of our God that the king and his counselors and his lords and all Israel there present had offered. I weighed out into their hand 650 talents of silver and silver vessels worth 200 talents and 100 talents of gold, 20 bowls of gold worth 1,000 derricks and 2 vessels of fine bright bronze as precious as gold. And I said to them, you are holy to the Lord and the vessels are holy and the silver and gold are a freewill offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers. Guard them and keep them until you weigh them before the chief priests and the Levites and the heads of fathers' houses in Israel at Jerusalem within the chambers of the house of the Lord. So the priests and the Levites took over the weight of the silver and the gold and the vessels to bring them to Jerusalem to the house of our God. Then we departed from the river Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes by the way. We came to Jerusalem, and there we remained 3 days. On the 4th day, within the house of our God, the silver and the gold and the vessels were weighed into the hands of Meremoth, the priest, son of Uriah, and with him was Eleazar, the son of Phinehas, and with them were the Levites, Jozabad, and the son of Jeshua, Noadiah, the son of Binui. The whole was counted and weighed, and the weight of everything was recorded. At that time, those who had come from captivity, the returned exiles, offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, and as a sin offering, 12 male goats, All of this was a burnt offering to the Lord. They also delivered the king's commission to the king's satraps and to the governors of the province beyond the river, and they aided the people and the house of God. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, all eyes up here. This is not just grown-up time, right? God cares about every one of you kids. He wants you to know that he loves you and how you can love him. So let me ask you a question. Sometimes, do you ever really, really, really wish it was summer? When it's really cold and you've been cooped up in the house a long time, do you just wish it was summer and no school? You could just play? Sometimes that's called longing for something, wanting something really bad. Or maybe sometimes you like really, really wish it was Christmas. Do you ever look forward to Christmas and just long for it to be Christmas time? Really wish all you could have all the cozy decorations out and the music, and you just really wish, oh, it seems so long. When's it going to be Christmas? Well, the Bible tells us we should long for lots of different things. We should really, really want some things. And know what one of the things the Bible tells us we should long for? To be in heaven. And we shouldn't think, no, all the best stuff's going to happen here on earth. The Bible wants you to really, really, really long to be in heaven, where finally you won't sin anymore, right? And nobody will be mean to you anymore. And we'll finally get to see God. And there will never be no sadness anymore. And you know why you're allowed to long for heaven, to really, really want to be there? Because Jesus died for you so you could be there. You don't have to worry that you won't be there. If you believe in Jesus, he says all your sins that would keep you out of heaven, they're forgiven. Jesus took your punishment for you. And God says, then I'm going to love you forever. And when you die here, you're going to go be with me and all the other Christians forever in heaven. It's hard for us to imagine how awesome it's going to be, isn't it? But it's better than anything you can imagine. And so we shouldn't try to find all of our happiness with just like getting more things on earth or being the most popular or having more friends. It's good to have friends, and it's nice when God gives us things, but we shouldn't make that what's most important. We should make loving God most important, and we should say, God, I can't wait to see you in heaven. That's what I want the most. And God will help change our hearts more and more to make us long for those things instead of just getting stuff here on earth. Can you think about that and ask God to help you with that? The more you think about how much Jesus loves you, the more it makes you long to be with him. Okay? Think about that during the sermon for me. Thank you. So, if you recall last week, Ezra began the plans for this return trip. This is not like the Exodus. So there's definitely some things that are supposed to remind you of it. But this is different. This is not an escape from slavery. They were not in Babylon longing and weeping to be singing the songs of Zion at home. It's been nearly 80 years since the first trip happened, and these had all chosen not to go. If you recall, when the first trip went, the people, the captives, as they were known, in Babylon, gave over $24 million in freewill offerings to send them on their way. They were doing pretty well in Babylon. Things were pretty comfortable. But Ezra, again, a man of great knowledge of the Word of God and a priest and a scribe, realizes this is not the ideal for God's people. This is not their home. And he's worried about how it's going at home, knowing that it's been 60 years since the temple was complete, and he's concerned that people are not obeying the law of the Lord. So he wants the worship of God to go well. He wants the building of God's kingdom to go well, not just building their own kingdoms in Babylon and getting rich here. And so with this being put on his heart by the Lord, he goes to the king and says, requests this trip to be sent. He saw the king lavished so much gold and silver and wine and oil and cattle, all they would need to make this trip home so that God can be worshipped well, his kingdom can be built well. And so I think this is a real picture of what we need to be longing for. The author of Hebrews tells us we need to be longing for a better country and not finding our worth and our happiness here with what we gather for ourselves. And so we see this trip is made as they are convinced that there's a better country somewhere else. And it's not going to be better earthly, be more earthly rich than Babylon. They're going to have to turn their backs on all that is comfortable to worship God well and build his kingdom instead of building their own. So how does God help you seek his kingdom? Seek a better country, which is what? Heaven. How does he help us find our hope there and help us pull out of finding our hope in the world? So, first, we'll see how he helps us leave the world behind. Something that is very difficult for all of us. We need to leave the world behind. But as ambassadors, our second point, we're to be in the world, not of it. So we're not shunning the world. We are not going along with it for how it finds its hope. And then finally, we see that we can do this because we can trust him that he's going to bring us home. This is not a journey that we have to accomplish ourselves. We can long for a better country because God's going to bring us there ultimately. So first, how do we turn away from the world? Or another way to phrase it, leave it behind. This is not easy if you've ever looked at how much you love the world. And so often we love building our own kingdoms. We love focusing only on what we want, what we need. And turning away from all that and building God's kingdom is not very appetizing for us because we see how much sacrifice it calls for. But while God is sovereign over all things, Babylon was not his kingdom. The Persian Empire was not his kingdom. The capital of his kingdom was Jerusalem. And there's a lot of contrast in the book of Ezra between Babylon and Jerusalem. And cities often take on symbolic things in the Bible. Babylon is often used as a symbol of self-indulgence and glorying in self and what man can do. Just like Egypt is often used as a symbol of relying on self instead of relying on God. But Jerusalem is obviously a symbol of what? Zion, the ultimate home for the people of God. And so it's a very definitive picture we have here, being called to leave Babylon and all the glorying in self and all the pleasure you can enjoy from the world and going instead to Jerusalem, a picture of eternal joy, though it might not be full of physical pleasures right now. It's very similar to the call God gave to Abraham. Abraham wasn't having to flee slavery and captivity. Abraham was with his family, doing fairly well. And God says, I want you to leave all you're familiar with, all that you're comfortable with, what you're settling for, and I want you to come here, a place I'm going to show you. And I'm sure that sounded absolutely insane to his family. What do you mean you're leaving? Where? I don't know yet. But God told me, which God? We worship several. Now, this other one you don't really know about. Yeah, right. I'm sure it was not an easy conversation. It's amazing that Abraham went. God obviously enabled him to do it. But it's amazing he just packed up what he had, left all that was going to be ultimately destroyed to go to a place that would give him eternal joy. And so here's how God describes Abraham's version of turning his back on the world to go to what would provide eternal joy. In Hebrews 11, God says, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him in the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. And that is difficult to do because we don't know what heaven's going to look like. We don't have an exact map. We don't have dimensions on what everything's going to do and a complete rundown of all the things you get to enjoy while you're there, okay? We're not planning a vacation here. We have to step out on faith, not knowing what it's going to be like, trusting, however, that God can't break promises. He has something for you, truly, that will be much more joyful than anything the world can provide. God's plan was not easy for Abraham. God does not promise you an easy journey this side of heaven, that you'll just be able to turn your back on all the things the world deceives you with, and you'll have no problem. He tells you it's going to be difficult. But he does also remind you you're going to succeed. So we need to remember when the world is calling your name, when you're finding yourself being tempted to find pleasure in what this world offers versus what God offers, we're exiles on this planet. This is not our ultimate home. a new heaven, a new earth is, but that's not this one. And the Jews in Babylon had forgotten, I think, that they were actually exiles. And Babylon had become their home. And they were given a choice by Ezra. Stay here and enjoy your riches, or go home where you belong, where you can be reminded of what? The Passover, as you celebrate it. As you can have God's reminders to you of each time we sacrifice that wrath has been turned away. We can celebrate the Day of Atonement, watching this picture of your forgiveness being given to you, celebrating his grace to you through the Feast of Booths and all these things God did in their life to remind them of his love. You could have all those reminders, or you could have your riches. Which one do you want? And those who went with him chose to find their identity in what they should have, in what's eternal, and not in all the pleasure they had here. They chose to remember, wait a minute, I'm an exile. This isn't my home. And the more you and I feel comfortable with the world's values and the world's priorities, with the greed that characterizes our culture, with the materialism, just the self-obsessed sense that we see all over social media that our culture promotes all the time, the more that's comfortable for us, the more we're forgetting we're exiles here. This is not where we belong. The world's priorities should not be ours. Hebrews 11 continues to talk about this exile mentality. These all died in faith, meaning the people who stepped out in faith in God. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, meaning because they were still in the future. God did not deny them. But having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. That's what we need to be longing for. Things that characterize hope in what he has promised us, and not things that characterize what can I do for me now. And I think we are very much, when we are challenged on those things, I think we're very much like Lot's wife. We know it's all going to burn. And we're called to turn our back on it, but we just can't stop looking back longingly. And we see what happens to her for doing that. I'm not saying you should all be worried about being turned into pillars of salt next time you're materialistic. But we see how God views being offered salvation and escape from his wrath and kind of saying, yeah, but look at all that. It's so much fun. I love being able to find my identity in things that are tangible, that I've accomplished myself, because that doesn't take faith. I love finding my security in how much I've got saved up in the bank. That doesn't take any faith. I know if a problem happens, I'm okay. I don't like being in places where I have to actually trust God, where things are outside of my control. And every one of us has different ways that we struggle with that. I don't know how exactly you struggle with just resting in God, how you handle things that are not in your control. But I don't think any of us loves that. But God always uses those times to produce phenomenal things in his children. So let me ask you for a moment of self-evaluation. In what ways does the world hold too much of your hope? You know it's all going to burn up. But yet, how much time do you spend worrying and planning and devoting resources to things that ultimately are going to burn up? Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to devote time to and resources to things that are not eternal. You're called to provide for your family. You're called to take care of children, taking care of other people. You're called to do that, okay? It's not wrong to devote time and resources to things that are temporal. But how much of your time and your worrying and your resources are spent on things that are not rightly before you? And what I mean by that is this. Many of these things might be good things, too. It's good to take care of family, for instance. But how many of these things are done because you are pursuing the world's approval rather than looking at these things as ways to glorify God? So, for instance, a good job is a great gift from God. How much time do you spend working at your job seeking to be viewed as the best employee? Not to honor the Lord with the resources he's given you because you want that recognition. See, now it's about things that are going to burn up. When it could have been about, Lord, thank you for this job. Let me honor you every second I'm on the clock. Or how many of you as students are seeking to be recognized as the absolute best because you want to be known as the smartest, the best in the class, the teacher's favorite, instead of using the brain God gave you and the other things he's given you to thank him, that you get to go and study and learn these things and become better at what you're trying to do. And I'm not singling you ladies out here at all because you're worse at this. I just think social media has made it more difficult on you. How many of you think you need to present to the world that you are the most perfect mom with the most perfect kids as social media defines perfection? And there we have this beautiful gift of God giving you children to love and rear to thank him. And it becomes, no, I need to be recognized as the best mom with the best kids through likes. Because those really last forever. So again, not singling you out because you're worse. I think the system has singled you out and preyed on you. And I'd love to be able to leave this last one off the list, but I can't. I battle this desire to be recognized as the greatest pastor far more than I'd like you to realize. And I'm ashamed of that. Because what a precious gift all of you are. And I need to thank the Lord all my days for this opportunity and not turn it about me getting recognized by whoever it is I have a whim, a desire to be recognized for that moment. So when the world is calling our name and we're listening, we take good things and turn them into ways to get the world's love instead of loving our Father who loves us unconditionally. So we can rationalize things well in this regard. So I have to provide for my family. God calls me to. Which all of a sudden turns into needing the nicest house I can get. Most certainly not a need to have a house nicer than your neighbor's. Or I need to take care of the resources God gives me. I have to spend the most money so I have the nicest looking yard in the neighborhood. Mine has to be better than theirs. Or the car I drive has to be better than so-and-so's. Because why? Because I want people to recognize it. So again, remember when you are battling those things, remember Lot's wife. All of that is going to burn up. It will not last forever. Chase after the things that will. Again, devoting resources to temporal things in a way that honors the Lord, that thanks him for those gifts. Now you're doing things that will last forever, laying up treasure in heaven. It's not that the temporal world is worthless or bad. It's not. We just turn it into the things that we worship or ways we can worship ourselves. We use it to promote us and get comfortable in the Babylon of this world instead of seeing the resources as only means of loving others and loving the Lord. But I will admit, sometimes I think we do not just spend time and resources. Sometimes it's not lust for the world that we're after. I think it's just the amount of time we spend doing things that aren't glorifying to the Lord. If we just charted out our time and how it's spent each day, how much of it could have been spent meditating on God's love for us? How much could have been spent meditating on how he wants me to change? How much time could have been spent looking for opportunities to serve others? This is not so much lust for the world as it is, it's just the run of the mill. It's just what's comfortable. It's just what we're familiar with. I didn't sit out and say, man, I want the world's approval tonight. What can I do to get it? I just came home and I watched the usual amount of TV tonight because that's what I felt like doing because that's what I always do. That's the idea of just the comfort lulling you to sleep in Babylon instead of saying, no, it's going to be difficult to turn my back on all this, to go build God's kingdom. But that's my home. That's where I belong. And God has made it worth it. That's how I need to be spending my time, not the comforts of Babylon. So again, I don't think often that's even intentional. It's just the familiar. And God called them to leave the familiar for the eternal. And he calls us to the same. So we also need to hear God's warnings about being too comfortable with the world. It's not just, come on, if you guys stick around in Babylon, you're going to miss out. Remember, Feast of Weeks. No, it's not that. It's, no, you're choosing to not be with the people of God. You're choosing not to celebrate what he's called you to celebrate. You're choosing intentionally not an eternal joy for a temporal one. So listen to 1 John chapter 2. Do not love the world or things in the world. For if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, the pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. John says something very similar to what the author of Hebrews is saying. Find your hope in the things that are eternal and don't make your worth the world's approval of you. James chapter 4 comes on a little stronger. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. I'm not saying you guys can lose your salvation, nor is he. But it shows when the values of the world butt up against the values God has called you to cherish. And you choose the values of the world, you're choosing to act like an enemy of the Father who loves you. And we all do it. But we're called to so much more. And so, not beating ourselves up over this, but realizing, okay, I'm not just supposed to turn away from the world, but I'm supposed to turn toward Jerusalem, right? Remember when Daniel was second in command, basically running all of Babylon, could not have arisen higher? What did he do three times a day? He went to his windows that faced Jerusalem because he knew that's where his hope came from, not from what he accomplished in Babylon. You truly could not have climbed higher, probably in the world at that day, than Daniel. And he said, my hope is there. That's eternal. This, I'm trying to glorify the Lord with what he's given me to do here in Babylon. My hope is there. So we turn away from the world that says, no, it's all about you. You need our approval. Do what we want. And we turn toward the Lord who says, but I love you more than they could ever love you. And my love lasts forever. So listen to Paul in Colossians 3. If then you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. He's not trying to tell you to be a mystic, some kind of mystic. He's not trying to tell you that earthly things are evil. You need to rise above in some kind of higher plane. He's not saying that. He's saying, no, what's above is what's eternal. Think about what Christ has done for you. He's your life, he said here. Christ is your life. Ponder his love for you, and then the future you have that's guaranteed can't be taken away from you because you're going to see him in glory. Keep that in mind, and then the things of this world are put in their place. Oh, yes, God has created this world, and he's given me things and people in this world to work with for his glory. But that's it. It's not my hope tied to this. They don't define me. Christ is your life, Paul says. That defines you. Your future should be where your hope is set. So God called Abraham to do more than just leave, right? He called him to go to the promised land. He directed him. His faith led him there. The hope was guaranteed. God couldn't break his promise. And that's what he calls us to as well. So the world is always going to have that lure of forbidden fruit to you if you're not comparing it with the future God has for us. So it's not just turn away. The world's bad. It's going to sound all the more sweet to you if that's your mentality. It's, no, the world is something God made and it can be used for his glory, but it can't be a hope. Turn away from that as hope. Turn toward what Christ has done. There's your hope. And that'll put the world in perspective. So that first point was quite long. Don't worry, the next two are not as long. Our second point, though, we're not supposed to shun the world. Okay? As ambassadors, we need to be in it, but not of it. So, as ambassadors, you have to be working with the world. among the people we've been sent to promote our home country's business, right? But as ambassadors, we are not monks, okay? We are not called to shun the world and remove ourselves because the world's so dirty, we don't want to have any part of it. And it can be easy to twist these scriptures into thinking that because, let's be honest, often it is more fun to be with Christians. And we are good. We'll be around those people. They won't show our kids anything we don't want them to ever see or model. Instead of raising our kids in the world and realizing we point out to them when the world shows them what not to model. We don't just keep them from it. We got to be in the world, but not of it. So too often we make this mistake. And that turns our mission as ambassadors upside down. What kind of ambassador is making any headway in this foreign country if he has no interaction with the foreign country? He's not going to last long. And they're going to replace him with someone who does. Now, I'm not saying you're going to be replaced as a Christian if you don't interact with enough non-believers. But remember, that is the word God used for us. And it is what our mission's about. Letting people know there is a better country than the one you're in. And you're not going to see it this side of heaven, but it will last forever. And it's given to you as a gift because Christ accomplished all that's needed to be a part of it. Put your hope there. So, we can't tell them about the better country if we never interact with them. So, don't hear turning away from the world as being a shun. Paul had to clarify this with the Corinthians when he was telling them not to associate with sexually immoral people. In chapter 1, verse 5, he says, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. Not at all meaning the sexually immoral of the world, or the greedy, or swindlers, or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. But now I am writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of a brother, if he is guilty of sexual immorality or greed, or is an idolater, reviler, drunkard, or swindler. Do not even eat with such a person. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? God judges those outside. Purge the evil person from among you. So they were tolerating evil within the church, not confronting it, being proud of their more tolerant than thou attitude. Paul says, hold on. No, I told you not to associate, and I didn't mean the outsiders. You'd have to leave the world. That's ridiculous. God takes care of them. You worry about the body of Christ. Hold them accountable. So we're not called to leave the world. We're called to be in it, not of it. But we're also not called to be rebel zealots. We're not called to fight the world. And we often make the battle about flesh and blood, so often. And we look at voices in the world that are very hostile towards Christianity, and they're only growing. And we get consumed with that and forget that the battle belongs to the Lord. And he says the battle's against spiritual forces. Other non-Christians, no matter how hostile they might be to you, are not ultimately who the battle's against. They are a target we're trying to win for Christ, not someone we're trying to destroy. You recall when Jeremiah wrote his letter to the captives when they first got sent ages ago now to Babylon, he told them to what? Build houses, settle down, live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives, have sons and daughters, take wives for your sons, give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease. Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare. They were supposed to be great citizens in Babylon and not fight against it. Work well for it because, hey, you live there. If it prospers, you prosper. This whole time, as Ezra has been seeking to go back, they have been working with Babylon. They're not fighting against the world. They're respectful, thanking them for what's been given to them. And that's the way we need to be as well. If there are voices against Christianity, confront them with respect and love. That might mean you have to have some hard words here or there. I'm not saying you got to be a doormat. But we can't be tricked into thinking that other people are ultimately our enemy. We're to love our earthly enemies if they treat us that way, but the battle is against what Satan is doing to blind them. The battle is a spiritual one that we need to ask God to win with the advance of the gospel. So we can't act as though we have to fight the world when we're trying to turn away from it. Instead, we realize I'm sent into the world with this message of hope. I cannot value what they value, and I cannot hope in what they hope for. I have to show them the better country they could be a part of by radiating hope in the face of their persecution. And our final point, that's going to take a lot of faith on our part, just like it took for Abraham. So we need to trust that our God is going to bring us home. We're not just going to long for this better country and never get there. In God's book, you're already seated there with Christ, he tells us. That's hard to believe. It sure feels like you're sitting on an uncomfortable metal chair. But in God's book, it's already done. There's no possible way that if you have come to faith, that somehow that faith can be stopped and you've lost your seat in heaven. It's a guarantee that you're going to be there because we're seated with Christ. It took immense faith for Ezra to make this journey. He's got to go to the king and request something outlandish, which could easily be result in death. The king lavishes so much grace and kindness on him. But then, if you saw, it took immense faith for him not to request a military escort. It was about between 900 and 1,000 mile journey in very harsh terrain. And if you recall, all the gold and the silver that was lavished on them, at least according to gold and silver prices last week, the total they were carrying with them, with no escort, was $179,768,520 worth of treasure. Just shy of $180 million, and he does not request an escort. His shame there, he says, I was ashamed to ask for an escort, is not sin on his part. Why did he say he didn't request one? I've been telling them how powerful my God is, that his hand is on us, that he'll do what we ask. I got to show that I believe that. That it's his will for us to go home, and he's going to get us there. So I'm not going to put my trust in what the world could do to make it easier. I'm going to put my faith in a God who cannot break promises. And God does what? More than they could ask or imagine. Delivered them safely, Ezra goes out of his way to say, we humbled ourselves, we fasted, we sought his safekeeping, and what? He listened to our entreaty. His hand was on us. And he protected us from the enemy and ambushes, he said. Everything was safely delivered. The better country they longed for, they got to, with more grace given them than they ever could have imagined. I want you to take stock of that picture, because that's what's going to happen to all of you who trust in Christ. You are going home. As painful as your journey's been now, as difficult as your lust after the world has made it for you, as difficult as the world's response to you when you've tried to pull out has made it for you, you are going home. Nobody can keep you out. Nothing in all creation can separate you from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. That means you're part of creation. You can't separate yourself. Paul says in that great passage, neither the present nor the future, nor any power. So nothing in the future can separate you from his love for you. You are going home. Remember that? Remember that when you are experiencing this world's greatest joys, so they don't overtake your ultimate hope. And remember it when you are at places darker than you ever thought possible, when hope seems more distant than it's ever been. Remember, you are going home. Who's calling you home? It's your Father who loves you, not some tyrant who can't wait to kill all the happiness you have in this world. It's a Father who knows what's better for you, that this world can't give it to you. He designed you meticulously. God designed each one of you to find your greatest joy in worshiping him. So that means you need to take stock of your life and say, where am I choosing to just spend my resources and my time on things that will never satisfy? Where am I using my time to not meditate on things that will fill me with joy? And how am I not responding to the joy given me by serving and how I've been served? By a God who loves me, a Father who's done everything to free me from the slavery of sin so I can make this journey home. And so, what does he want you to do? Because of the mercy he's shown you, to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Just like Romans 12, 1 and 2 says. Every day, Lord, renew my mind so more of it is finding its joy in you and what's eternal, and less of it is lusting after what this world can offer. And we need to beg him to help us have the mentality he gave to Moses, described for us in Hebrews 11. What does Hebrews 11 say to Moses, who was what? Prince of Egypt, right? Could have enjoyed a life more lavish than any of us will probably know. But in Hebrews 11 it says, but he chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. That's the mentality we need to have. This world offers you only fleeting pleasure. And even a difficult journey with Christ is worth far more than the best this world can offer. So flee. Flee the self-reliance of Egypt. Cling to your father. Flee all the fleeting pleasures of Babylon. They will never satisfy you. Run toward Jerusalem. Run toward your father who's calling you home. And find joy in his love for you, which lets you let go of all you're trying to accrue for yourself and say, well, who can I serve then? Because I'm taken care of. My future's secure. Nobody can take it from me. Why? Because of what 1 Peter tells you. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed at the last time. That is your future. You can't change it. So flee the things that get in the way of a clear view of the hope you have. Because your father's calling you home. And someday, you will see him face to face. Thanks to Christ.